netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by SIGGRAPH Asia 2012 in Singapore from November 28th to December 1st. FX Guide is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. We have a special show for you today, part of our Master of the Craft series, an interview with Richard Chung, who co-founded PDI DreamWorks over 30 years ago, which in 1998 received an Academy Technical Achievement Award for its proprietary animation system. At PDI DreamWorks, Richard was responsible for developing production capacity globally for DreamWorks Animation. He is currently CEO of CloudPic and will be speaking at SIGGRAPH Asia about the rise of computer graphics in Asia. Before we get to that discussion, I wanted to give you a quick update about the new term over at fxphd.com. The October 2012 term is already in full swing and features a great lineup of the best in online visual effects training. You may have heard about the 3-day practical effects seminar we did in cooperation with 3210 Studios. 3210 is in the old Kerner Optical ILM space, and we had an amazing time shooting effects elements for some short films with a legendary crew. But while we were having a great time blowing stuff up, it was not in a vacuum. We had to figure out how these elements were going to be used, matching existing photography. It was a great session and is the basis for the DOP 215 course, Practical and Digital Effects. This is a really special course, working to give you more of a vocabulary if you have to shoot practical elements. We also have an Arnold class, Introduction to Arnold, ARN 101. On the Houdini side, we have both Introduction to Houdini 12, Part 2, as well as Destruction in Houdini 12. There's a V-Ray character look development course, Modo, Part 2 of our VFX Foundations course, so much more, 106 courses in all, an amazing lineup with first-rate professors who are all working professionals. Plus, we provide access via VPN to many of the software packages for members, so you can get your hands on and build your reel all at prices you won't believe, starting at just $299. So head over to fxphd.com and enhance your existing skills or learn some new ones. There's also plenty of fresh content over on FX Guide. A recent FX Guide TV has a preview of the new term and more about shooting the 3210 Studios seminar. We've got the scoop on Digital Domain's latest for Linkin Park, exclusive coverage of the Foundry Luxology merger, a report from the recent Visual Effects Society Production Summit, where VES members gathered to discuss tax incentives, hear from space pioneers, explore disruptive business models, get the answer to the question, what happened, from the new CEO of Digital Domain, Ed Albrecht, and a special conversation with industry pioneer Scott Ross, former head of ILM and co-founder of Digital Domain. He gave a very frank and passionate look at the serious business issues facing visual effects studios. Also, lastly, I want to highlight that FX Insiders can access special behind-the-scenes from the sci-fi series Continuum, as well as bonus interviews on Hotel Transylvania. Okay, so much going on, but let's jump now into our discussion between our Mike Seymour and Richard Chung.
Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us. We really appreciate it. It's a great honor.
No, same here. I've been watching your ecosystem for quite a while. So.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I've got to say, I think I met you, but it was years ago. I remember meeting Carl. It was at, I'm thinking, either 1987 or 1988 at a BDA in LA at the Bonaventure Hotel. And the reason I bring this up is that PDI is immensely was immensely successful. Your career was immensely successful at PDI for two reasons. One, creatively, but I think also it just should be pointed out that you joined a company and then helped build a company that survived profitably, independently, and creatively for an incredibly long time before even the merger. That length of time is something most people, I guess, don't lead with, but I'm going to lead with it because I think it's an astounding feat in an age where razor-thin margins and stuff. You guys just managed the business well.
We're actually quite proud of that. I think what even prouder is the amount of people we're able to impact over the years. Because when we started it, we had a very simple approach to the business. And, you know, I came from a family of entrepreneurs. My mom started a business very early on when I was a child. And I learned from her that a business is about people. You know, forget the technology, forget everything else. If you don't focus on valuing your people, you're not going to be successful. So we weren't a flashy company by any means because we're not that good at publicity. But we really nurture a very great group of talent. I mean, I'm very proud to say, you know, that the people I've worked with over the years have done far more successful things than I have, and I'm very proud of that.
And today you're with CloudPick. Tell us about that.
Uh-huh. Okay. CloudPick started as sort of an interesting story there, if you have a few moments.
Absolutely.
I been at PDI at that point for about 28 years. We were, you know, Carl sold his share, so we became part of DreamWorks because he owned majority of PDI. And we were part of DreamWorks, and we stopped doing our service work back in 2002. After that, I became sort of an executive of DreamWorks, sort of responsible for, you know, a lot of production issue. But I convinced Jeffrey that it was time to really look at talents around the world. Because I started out, you know, mostly just, you know, helping with our CG animated film production. But having served on many SIGGRAPH committee as well as on jury for several film shows, I was seeing that there's a tidal wave of new talent coming along. And I convinced Jeffrey that we should look around the world and work with talents around the world. So I had a chance to help set up an operation in Hong Kong for doing a TV series, help set up the Indian operation for DreamWorks. So I was seeing firsthand just this groundswell of new talent and new creativity all over the world. And a lot of it, you know, thanks to, you know, a website like yourself and the other community who have really exposed the knowledge to a much broader audience and help contribute to the collaboration in a more global sense. And at the point, I think it was 2007 or something like that, I think Disney contacted me to consider helping them run the new studio they were building for Bob Zemeckis. Mm-hmm. That's what at the point when I went out, I go, wow, you know, after doing this all these years, it'd be fun to start another studio. So I sort of looked at that with a lot of curiosity. But what I found is I didn't really want to build another big studio, having built one of probably the larger one. Because at that point, I think when I left DreamWorks, we were over 2,000 people at that point. I really felt like the world didn't need another big studio. And at that point, my son was young. He was 15. And so he was doing a lot of project online with friends using game engine. He was writing a script, setting out to friends, and they were doing project online. I noticed that, God, this new next generation may not want to be sitting inside one of these huge studios that I'm used to. So the whole concept of CloudPick is really to take all the knowledge, experience, not just myself, but from the team I worked with over the years, and how to reinvent the process of creating content, and how do we address some of the issues that a lot of the artists face today working in the digital realm, and trying to find a baseline that is able to make life easier for everybody. That's how CloudPick got started.
Now, you say you don't want to build another studio, but talk to me, because in about a year, no, maybe almost 2 years ago now, there was a press release about you securing funding for a new virtual studio in Asia via Singapore, which of course is where SIGGRAPH Asia is going to be this year.
Oh, yeah.
What's that?
Oh, I think the people always mislabel it. I think it's virtual studio is a term that I wish people don't use. when we built CloudPick, it was really, I tried to look at it from an artist's perspective. You know, I came from an art background myself. Most people don't know that. I actually started in college as a painter. And I really felt like I need some way to take all the advantage we have gained in working in large projects and build something that allowed an artist. Here's the way I envision it, right? Let's say you're an artist working at home. You suddenly came up with this brilliant idea and say, hey, I want to do this. And you want to now invite a few friends, start working on a project, and scale it up from that point. What are the barriers that makes it difficult to do, right? First is you need to collaborate. You need to share things. You need to provide security and transparency. Some of the same issue we address in the large studio. Because when we set up multi-location project back at the big studio, it was a very expensive endeavor. Right, you have big servers, you have a lot of IT people. Next thing you know, you got all these security systems in place, and it's just painful to do. So what we hope to do is provide something that's really from an artist's perspective, that you can one-click create a project, on your next click invite a friend, and your friend can accept in one click and be able to now have you built a virtual working environment that are connected together where all the consistency, all the asset management already done automatically for you. So it's secure, reliable, transparent, without you having to have any time spent on technology. As much as technology is important, but I really feel like, you know, the artist's perspective is not what they where they want to spend their time. In fact, when I first started CloudPig, the first version we built was so convoluted that when I took it out and I actually sat in homes of artists watching how they work, and I realized we built the wrong thing.
So, the company's based in Singapore, I think, as its headquarters, but has R&D obviously in the States. But I mean, if someone goes,
we're actually a global company. Okay. We have an office in Singapore and the States, and you know, it's set up as a company that has many global footprint.
But if I was to go to the website today and I can sign up for the beta, is that what is that a beta of?
The beta is just our base software that really allows people to connect together, what I just described to you. Allow you to create a project, you get a virtual storage device, you invite a friend, he accepts it, he gets a virtual drive on his machine. We do not impose how you work, what tool you work, because we're agnostic. We basically provide infrastructure to let you connect people together in a very friendly way. And we actually never see the data. The data is stored in a peer-to-peer fashion between you and your friends and you and your partner or collaborator. And we really want it to be almost free and have no cost. In fact, we're probably going to give it out to free for people in small project. And where people can now start constructing this virtual environment with almost no cost. And ease of use and no cost is very important to me. Because I'm not here to build big studio. I'm here to enable artists to work with other artists.
So if I was listening to this, I might say, isn't that Dropbox? What you know, describe
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, Dropbox is interesting. I mean, I follow many people using Dropbox for project. I think Dropbox solved the sharing in a very simple way. But when you're working a large project, many people working the same shots at the same time, you know, how you manage all that, how the transparency is, how the security is on your local device. We sort of address a lot of issues that's not being addressed by Dropbox. I mean, Dropbox is actually a viable starting point, but it's not a scalable for at least the content creation space, as most people have found out.
Well, now,
is Dropbox a good place to exchange information, but it's not a working environment?
So I started out the discussion by talking about PDI. I wonder if I can go back and work our way from PDI forward to this environment so we can understand your role with the artist. And I was lucky enough to hear you talk at SIDGRAPH with Ed Catmull,
who's
it was phenomenal hearing your perspective. And what I think is really interesting is, for me, of course, you're one of the leading luminaries, the sort of old guard, the people that I look up to and respect. But it sounded like you had that kind of attitude towards Ed, which I thought was really kind of interesting, this idea of you actually monitoring, I think, lectures that he was giving at one stage. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Oh, yeah, it's actually an interesting story. I started out as an art student, and I found out quickly you can't make a living in art, so I ended up in pre-med, and I ended up in engineering. So I ended up taking a job at Hewlett-Packard in the RF and microwave lab. Okay, this is a totally side story here. And when I was working there, HP at that point, very engineering-focused, they gave a lot of luxury to the engineers. And the one thing they provided was microwave streaming is not the word. Nobody invented streaming back then. This is back in 79-80 time frame. They were getting microwave feed of classes from UC Berkeley. An engineer can sign up for these classes and, you know, on their off hours go, let's watch these classes. It's sort of an enrichment program for engineer at HP. And I was working at RF and micro lab as a hardware engineer. And on my spare time, I would watch these videos from Ed and really got intrigued by computer graphics because, for me, I was a painter that has a lot of limitation. I couldn't work with a lot of medium because I was allergic to linseed oil and turpentine. So I had to learn a new form of art form. And computer graphics was the ideal art form for me. You know, so like, hey, no allergy, right? So I got into computer graphics and based on a lot of this class that Ed taught, and many years, and I actually, it's a very interesting story because over the years, even though Ed didn't know I took his course originally, after I wrote the renderer PEI, which was the first render we used, and actually it was just retired a few months ago. It actually is the longest lasting piece of software ever used in our industry, I think. And PDI finally retired it, I think, earlier this year. I made my first picture. I'll never forget this. It was a Boston SIGGRAPH. And I saw Ed Catmull in the hallway in the hotel. I mean, I was a nobody back then, right? Never really done this before. But I wrote my first renderer. And I brought my picture on a Polaroid and stopped Ed in the hallway. And he gave me half an hour of his time giving me critique. And that, to me, is the same philosophy I carry all my life, is that no matter what position I'm at, it's always my job to help somebody else get better at what they do because I'm helping to promote the industry. You know, what Ed helped me with in the get-go is something I always remember.
So now you met Carl and became – well, tell me about meeting Carl because you became like effectively a sort of employee number – well, a co-founder, but I mean, you know, with Carl, the start of PDI.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was one of the earliest hardware geek about microprocessor in Silicon Valley. Actually, I was at Steve Jobs' launch of the Apple II when at the San Francisco Convention Center when he launched Apple II. Wow. And so I was really – my hobby was building computer. I actually built my first computer in 1976. This is another story. I was an artist, but my hobby was building computer. So when I came out here, even though I worked at the RF microwave lab, I always had intuition and love building computers. And HP volunteered me to be head of the IEEE, Institute of Electrical Engineering, special interest group of microprocessor in Silicon Valley back in 1980. Which is sort of, you think back at it, if I had invested $100 in everybody in my group that year, I would have been long retired. And that was like just on the onset when microprocessor became sort of, you know, acceptable in the technology field. You know, home computer hasn't really taken off at that point. But that year, Carl was the head of the special interest group on graphics. So once in a while we have these sort of IEEE meeting where we, you know, get everybody together and sort of talk about, you know, sort of love stuff that's not that relevant. And I met him, and he was like, you know, I was very intrigued by the fact that he had family money. He really wanted to start this graphics business. And I, you know, having had that, taken that class from Ed, I was very intrigued by it. So when Carl started to do his business, he really needed to set up his equipment. He really didn't know how. So he asked me, hey, you want to help me do this? And he wasn't really interested in hiring me at this point because I really have no background in graphics. But I said, hey, look, I love to make pictures. And since you can afford to buy a frame buffer, back then a 512 by 512 24-bit frame buffer cost him $65,000, right? But luckily he had money to do that. I said, look, I'll help you set up your equipment. In exchange, just give me time on your computer so I can make pictures. Because I was willing to barter my time to just access the equipment so I can make picture, and that's how I got started.
Yes, we've talked to people like Jim Blinn, and as part of this foundation series, and that access to a frame store can't be overrated, can it? It was really a pivotal aspect.
Absolutely.
Of sort of like a barrier to entry. If you couldn't get near a frame store, you couldn't do work.
Well, that's why I dropped out of graduate school. I was doing graduate school and doing image processing at UC Davis. And it took us 15 minutes to transpose a 256 by 256 image, right? Something you don't even think about in all nowadays. Back then, it was painfully slow. So when I got involved with Carl having access to a real 24-bit frame buffer was a dream come true. I now I can make full color images.
Yeah. Now let me just ask you about this, because again, going back to this period where I entered the, just being so aware of your work, it seemed to me that even though you started with what I believe was a PDP-11 machine.
Yes, PDP-1144, 16-bit machine. It was my first render was written on a 16-bit machine. It was painful, but got to work. You render a scan line at a time.
But
16-bit machine, you can't hold a full image in memory, so.
But while that's the history of, obviously, like the first computer, and it's significant in that respect, for me, as I say, and I'm entering the picture now, like more around 87, 88, a few years after you've started, What was the difference in PDI was that you guys were very fast, if not the first, to adopt what I'm going to call what was back then general workstation, as opposed to going the other way, which seemed to be to, invest in a Cray supercomputer or later the thinking machines, parallel processing machines. You guys went straight to the workstations, and all the other companies that seemed to go to the big iron, big million-dollar supercomputers went out of business. Would you agree that was a pivotal decision?
It's pivotal now that we look back at it. But back then, see, don't forget my story that I was a microprocessor geek, right? I knew more about that type of computer architecture than most people because I came from a hardware background.
Yep.
So I understood what we did and what type of machine best suit our needs. I mean, you plot the value curve between cost and performance, and there's absolutely no reason you would buy a Cray. Right. And in fact, it was sort of, I never forget the day when Digital Production announced they got a Cray. You know, initially it was sort of shocking, like, wow, there goes the industry, they can afford a Cray. But that later that day, I never forget, me, Carl, and Glenn sat on the floor and go, well, there goes the industry, we can never afford to compete. But, an hour later, I did the math and I say, forget it, these guys will never last because they can't afford it. Right. If you have any business sense, you understand the cost value, you can quickly calculate that. The return on investment on a Cray doesn't justify the business we were in.
Now Glenn joined the picture in 82, right after you, but explain who he is. Yeah.
Oh, Glenn Entes actually came from a very strong graphics background. He was working initially worked at Ampex, working on a paint system. Then he went to HP and worked on graphics. So Glenn is sort of have a depth of knowledge in graphics that neither Carl and I had. So when he first came in, he brought a lot of existing knowledge and a lot of creativity to the process. I mean, Glenn came from, I think he had a master's degree in philosophy or something like that, but it came from a very strong creative background. And so it was good. The three of us were in some way very complementary in terms of our skills. I had no ability to promote anything. I was just mostly the backroom guy working my buns off. So this is love making picture. And Carl was excellent in presenting a clear vision to the world and other people. So it was a good, very complimentary group.
So I certainly was very aware of your work in that period of the end of the 80s, because you were not just successful, you guys dominated the major market that was computer graphics, which at that time was really network ID stuff. In fact, people think of computer graphics today being, a feature film kind of dominated thing. But back then, all the best people and the only good work was being done in network IDs.
Yeah, I think in those early days, I mean, never forget, this is a funny story. We were all, most of us were single at that point. We always liked to go into a bar on a Monday night at 9 p.m. and impress all the girls. Because we can say at exactly 9 p.m., you have cable TV. Our work is on exactly at 9 p.m. on ABC, CBS, NBC, HBO, VH1, MTV, Cinemax. Pretty much across the board, our graphics were on every major cable station and broadcast network. So we did dominate that industry for a while. And we actually, at some point, stepped away from it. And I think part of our ability to last that long is not to be afraid of give up a successful business and move on to something new.
Yeah. So where did you go from that network ID stuff, which, as I say, was the big budget, you know, money jobs? I mean, mm-hmm. doing an NBC opener was just a huge prestige. But where did you move from network IDs?
We went on to – we started – one of the earliest groups that actually started a character animation group. We really believe in the fact that we will eventually someday be able to tell a story using computer graphics. I mean, we knew that we wanted to be telling story. We didn't have, you know, the funding that I think, you know, eventually Steve gave Pixar. But we were, you know – leading the charge in terms of building a character animation group. In fact, our first character animation group of full of people who are leader in the industry, or mostly director now, across the industry. And that was actually one of our proudest accomplishments, that recognizing that we can build a character group and develop that skills over a very long period of time and be able to take that knowledge and be able to turn back to and the audience and entertain the audience with using computer graphics.
In fact, the Pillsbury Doughboy was a really sort of notable point in that, wasn't it?
Oh, that was quite a challenge, because that was the first time a major icon, character icon used for advertising, was switched to using computer graphics. It was a very, very difficult process, to be honest. They were not sure it was even possible, right? They had these amazing handcrafted model, all the key pose for the Pillsbury Doughboy. In fact, the guy almost came in with a lockbox of these key poses they created over the years. And, you know, they were like golden goal reference. And if we didn't meet or exceed their expectation, we would not have gotten that job.
Another absolutely key job around this time, which I can just remember being so floored by and even stands up really well today, is the Michael Jackson black and white morphing, which just led to a revolution.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was a very fun time. I mean, we came up with these. Actually, there's a funny story behind that one, because we came, a lot of that technique for morphing actually came out when we were bidding on this the original Terminator the Abyss project for Jim Cameron, which was one of the first major CG visual effects projects. At the end, we didn't get this project. That project, because the studio thought, well, if this thing failed, PDIs can't afford to cover their ass versus, you know, if Industrial Light and Magic has George behind them. So we end up not getting the work, but we took a lot of the stuff we developed and ended up using them on the Michael Jackson project. And they were fun. I mean, they gave us a lot of room for experimentation. I think Michael had a very open mind to new ideas and new vision. And our team really came through on that one. And some of the work we did there on still some of the best work you even stand up very well today.
I think it was astounding. And it caused everybody to literally stare at the screen to try and see what was going on in a way that normally would break visual effects. But you guys nailed it. It was remarkable. It must have created enormous buzz at the time as well.
Yeah. I really believe, you know, when you build a company, you take risks, but you also take risks that people are passionate about. And you know your chance of success is much higher. Because I remember the team that worked on those projects. You know, they were so thrilled to be able to work on it, and you know, and the passion clearly showing the result.
And in terms of technological developments around your commercials work, am I right in thinking, now I don't know where I read this, but you might have used the world's first global illumination render for an ad, is that correct?
Yeah, we did. We actually did a GI project for Japan. It was a dinosaur skeleton falling asleep in the museum, and it was one of the first ones used in the commercial. It was one of our animator just decided, hey, this sounds cool, let's try it. And he just wrote it up himself, and we say, okay, let's try it. And, you know, risk-taking, that's the funnest part about the job.
Wow, it must have been incredible. Now, you've got the character work, you've obviously done music videos and commercials, but the big step was to get into feature film production, and it was the Holy Grail.
The first step was actually visual effects. That was actually a very tough road. For many years, people were not convinced that digitizing film was the right way to go. people were still very much stuck in the film world. You know, they say, hey, everything should be shot in the camera with Kodak film. And it was something that nobody saw, is how many years it took for us to convince people that it's okay to put a film onto digital format and put it back on film. So we ended up building our own film scanner. I don't know, most people don't remember that, but we actually built our own film scanner early on to convince people this can be done.
So you started this path into visual effects and animated features, and I understand from a lecture you gave at Stanford about 7 years ago that it was you first planned to do that in about 85.
Yep. Nilo Rodas, a very famous art director that worked for George Lucas, came to me one day and said, hey, I have this idea for a film. I heard about these CG thing. Can you tell me if it's even possible to make something like this in CG? And I looked at his work. They were brilliant. Because Nilo did a lot of design for George over the years, early years of the Star Wars film. And I said, okay, let me put a plan together. And I actually put a plan together and pitched it to George with Nilo back in 85. And, you know, George just laughed at us. He goes, oh, people can't do this. You guys got to be kidding. And the plan actually held up. It was not much different than how we made our first CG animated film. The structure of the team, the workflow. And we having gone through that exercise, we really all believe that we can do it. It's just a matter of when. We actually were in development with a CG film with Jim Henson early in the 90s. If Jim didn't pass away, we probably would have beaten Pixar out with a CG film by quite some time.
And this was all in the idea of a fully CG film was all in parallel with the visual effects work that the company was doing, right? Because you had managed to get effects work happening.
Yes.
So yeah.
We try to make those two really support each other, because we knew that we used each of those two genres as testing ground for new ideas. I mean, like, we did a lot of character work in visual effects. I mean, I was supervising all the work we did early on with Digital Human. I did some of the, I think, from what I can tell, some of the earliest Digital Human work done in feature film in Hollywood was some of the early Batman project I did. And they were challenging. I mean, we've stepped in the area that we didn't know how it was done, and we learned a lot from that.
So your first fully animated feature would be Ants, which would come out, I think, Correct. In 98, though in 95 you did the deal with DreamWorks.
Correct.
But 95 was also the year, I believe, you came out with the Simpsons 3D Homer, which was both one of the funniest things I've ever seen and also really unexpected for the Halloween episode.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, again, another these project where we were thrilled when they were convinced. I mean, you should have seen us. I mean, we were a bunch of kids, because we all, you know, so many of us at that point in time were so much fan of Homer Simpson, right? To have a chance to do that, it was like, you know, again, happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I mean, it really was, and it was a great in-joke to everybody as we all picked up on every sort of single reference that you guys managed to cram in the 3D world before he landed in the real world, as it were. And Ants would be the start of a very successful series of feature films. When that first happened, when you first merged and went into to DreamWorks Animation, tell me what that was like and what your actual role was and how it developed.
Initially, it was very separate, because DreamWorks at that point, when we signed the deal in 95, they were still mostly focused on 2D animation. Don't forget, they were in the middle of making Prince of Egypt. So initially, when we started Ants, we were not involved with them that much. It was a very separate entity altogether. So we had a lot of freedom. It was exciting, but also scary. I still never forget the day when, you know, production manager came to my office and go, hey, Richard, I think we all realize we have no idea how this can be done. So we sort of stopped that work, put everyone into a room, and basically said, look, guys, none of us ever done this before, right? But this is how we're going to do it. And you can, you know, I think a lot of the producers still remember that day when I walked everybody in the room through the steps, say, okay, you're going to start here, you're going to end here. That's it. We're going to go make it. Go back to work. And It was such a fun time. I mean, it's good to be on the edge of exploration. You know, I think being in the pioneer in that sense was very exciting. I think everybody will never forget that experience. It was a learning experience and a shared experience for all of us.
So without being in any way disrespectful, I do think, though, a little bit Ants was still somewhat in the shadow of Pixar, a shadow I think that you lifted with Shrek. I don't know if you'd agree about that, but I mean, by the time it was almost like Shrek let you kind of spread your wings in a way that established the studio much more independently. I guess there was obviously a crossover between what was happening with the Pixar film at the same time with The Bug's Life and Ants. But
That was interesting because I knew Steve Jobs pretty well. I was on the Next Computer Advisory Board.
Oh, really?
And even while I was at PDI. And some of the 3D stuff they were doing. And I still remember Steve invited me to the premiere on Ants, and he wasn't happy. I mean, not Ants, but Bug's Life. And I still remember, you know, Steve wasn't happy that we did Ants, and he was very vocal about it. And, you know, after I learned about the politics between all this big studio, you know, we were caught in it. We did the best of what we can. And I think we were all very proud of what we accomplished. In terms of how those films compare to each other, I think that's left to a group of people that beyond our scope of control. So
no, I realize that, but I think with Shrek, you really established a sort of a completely separate obviously very strong franchise. But it was a phenomenal sort of...
Shrek allowed us to exercise all of what we learned in the past. Ants didn't quite push us that far I think it's good first step because they weren't sure, we weren't sure we can pull it off. And to be honest, we didn't know we can pull it off either. But when Shrek came along, we had the utmost confidence that we can do whatever come along because Ants allow us to prove to ourselves that, okay, as much as we don't know, as a team, we can figure it out. And among all of us, we really believe that if we continue to work together, we can overcome any difficulty. And all the great things we learned in the past in terms of building a good character animation system, good facial animation, you know, be able to render really beautiful images within a reasonable budget was all within our grasp. And we did it very efficiently, and we had fun doing it.
Before we leave our discussion of PDI, and I do want to move on to some other things, I just wanted, there was a point in this lecture that you gave, at Stanford, which I thought was really interesting. I don't know if I could get you to comment on it. Now, this is admittedly 7 years ago, but it was a talk point where you were discussing the fact that more things change the more they stay the same. And you were quoting in that, the phenomenal computational changes and yet how much the artist's experience hadn't necessarily varied. Can you discuss that?
Yeah, being a computer geek, so I kept track of things like that. You know, people think like, you have better things to do than doing that. I mean, I'm sort of an old school guy. I still program myself. So one thing that was interesting is actually somebody started attaching this number to my name, which is sort of funny. Curious how people work and how much computer we keep buying and spending money. And how we started to track how we were working. And I realized at some point, no matter how much resource any animator get, they will end up needing more than what they have because they'll push against the limit of their patient and the patient of their management. So we, I think, have reached a point now since my talk many years ago at Stanford where I think we're beyond the scope of almost putting too much on the screen. I think because the visual complexity of what you can see on a theatrical screen has saturated. So I think given more and more computing power, we're just wasting time, I think. But over the years, you know, we had access to compute power, you know, from between my PDP 1144 to, you know, the day I left DreamWorks, you know, the access at my desktop to compute power were 50 million fold or something like that. I think today it would be over 100 million or 200 million fold within a large studio. And guess what? pictures still take just as long to make, and the time it takes to make a picture is still just as lengthy, which is actually what inspired me to really rethink everything. Because I really felt like we were hitting a dead end. Because in this world of mobile and direct communication between people, we really need to rethink that whole process. We need to deliver a lot more content, a lot more immediately, and respond to our audience much more directly and as individual, not as a large group. So I think that's where the shift to industry will be going, where now you're much more, as a content creator, you're no longer addressing a crowd, but you're addressing individuals. Because now you have access to what they like, what they don't like, and you now will have to build a process that can address that individual taste on a daily basis.
I was wondering if I could get you to talk to me geographically for a second, because you are speaking at SIDGRAPH Asia coming up, but also because you have links into Asia with the company, with CloudPix. What is your sort of view or perspective on computer graphics and animation studios in Asia at the moment?
My current perspective is, you know, go back to the early 2000s when I noticed that the flow of information have allowed a whole new generation of young artists to learn all the same skill we learned in the West. And we took advantage of some of that initially by building project here and build project in Asia and got some fantastic results. So we proved once and for early on that it's not an issue of the talent. It's really about the issue of people building the right environment to nurture that talent, building the group that allow them to flourish creatively and allow them to create greater projects. I think we are now in a threshold where no longer we see boundary in entertainment in terms of geographical boundary, social economic boundary, and cultural boundary. So I think Asia has an opportunity now to really step up and compete very nicely in this new world. I think it's really about the growth of maturity of management to understand how to build the proper environment for people to flourish creatively. I think this culturally, I think there's a lot of shift needs to happen in Asia, but it's starting to happen, and hopefully we'll see more of the result coming out of Asia this next few years.
You're obviously an incredibly successful Asian American, but what was your family's background? Where were they from in the region?
That was an interesting story. My mom was an entrepreneur. She was actually one of the first female entrepreneurs of Hong Kong in the early 60s. She was in the fashion business. I grew up watching her build a company out of her bedroom to thousands of employees. So I learned a lot from her in terms of as I mentioned earlier, in this discussion, to value people. My stepfather actually came from the movie industry in Hong Kong. He was head of PR for Shaw Brothers in the 70s.
Huh.
So if you know anything about movies in the 70s, Shaw was the most big studio in the world.
Yeah.
So I grew up learning a lot about, you know, how not to make a lot of movies. And my stepdad always advised me, stay away from the film business. But I think it's just I love making picture. I mean, that's why I'm doing what I do. And nothing more fun than seeing somebody's excitement, seeing something never seen before. So,
do you find that there is much in the way of a sort of a creative difference from the Asian community, the kids of today versus the kids that, well, let's call them kids, but the, you know, the younger people that were joining PDI back in the early heydays of the 90s? I mean, is it the same, do you think? Has everything moved on?
I think that in today's younger generation, they have, especially in the younger generation, they have, I think, much more capacity to be a much open thinker than they did back then. I mean, we had to overcame a lot of baggages, you know, when we were, you know, in the 80s. But I think this generation, because of the proliferation of information, a much more acceptance to change. I think, if anything, it's some of the older people who are running studio that needs to learn to be acceptance of change, you know, learn to accept this new generation of content creator and be able to, you know, build an environment that let them flourish, right? It's no longer building factory or bigger studios. It's really building a creative environment that, you know, let people express themselves. I think that's really the key.
You've talked at various times in your career about the sort of keys to success from a business point of view, and I just wanted to touch on in terms of CloudPix, because the business model that you had for PDI was I guess I'm going to call it very old school, in the sense that you guys didn't borrow money, you didn't spend beyond your means, you reinvested in the company, you didn't take money out of the company, and you survived very well. It's a low margin business. But today, yeah, you're talking about CloudPix as a company that's going to provide a lot of services, possibly for free. And I've got to say that the criticism that gets leveled at companies in this day and age is concern about having a sustainable business model. Right. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge, because today's world, people do expect so much for free, right? And that's why I always told my team in CloudPix, we're never going to be a big company. We might address a lot of people's need, but we'll build a business model that can sustain the company, but not build a company that has so much overhead that we cannot sustain it, right? It's really striking that balance that's important, right? And we want to be able to address a lot of needs. In fact, there's a lot of new area we can go into that make this business more palatable from the investor standpoint, and we will do that. The creative content space is the space we're most comfortable with. We'll enter in that first, but there's a lot of other area that we can leverage what we're building from a business standpoint. So we're in no way going to limit ourselves just to the creative content space. And but again, from our passion, this is where we start, came from, and this is where we'll start.
Because there is an enormous amount of money to be made in some respects. I mean, like an Instagram is a hugely a massive sale to Facebook, vast amounts of money. But by the same token, you know, I use an Instagram and I never pay them a cent, not that I'm aware of. It's easy for people to think that they're incredibly successful because they have lots of hits, though they have a business model that's surviving just on spending capital as if it was cash flow.
Yeah. I don't think that's sustainable. I mean, for us, it's really about servicing a community and be able to extract enough value to sustain the company. I mean, the larger user base, the vertical, we can move vertical, we can move horizontally as a business. Small and nimble is important. Building a really big business that just based on headcount is not that sustainable in most cases, because Instagram and Facebook, and obviously there's a few success stories that really stands out in today's world. But, you know, I always go back to when I started PDI. You know, what I learned back then still holds today. 96%+ of companies that start will fail. And you can't go into expecting to, just because you have 100,000 people or a million people, you're going to be able to survive that. That won't hold true. It'll never hold true in the past, and it'll never hold true in the going forward.
Let me ask your advice another way. There's been a lot of concerns about companies either failing or being having to shut, or the industry becoming incredibly fragmented and those margins becoming even thinner. Is it a good industry to be in, the visual effects animation industry, or is it really a time to move to a wider scope if you hope to make any money?
Right now is a very difficult time. I mean, having watched all the happening at DD in the last few months, you know, that's really sad to see happen, right? There's a very successful company, had quite a list of accomplishments under their belt. And industry is shifting. And how people get entertained is shifting. The old model is also not necessarily holding up that well, right? DVD sales is pretty much nil. And people want to be entertained differently. And where they want to be entertained, how they want to be entertained, have changed tremendously in the last few years. And I think what people need to do is learn to be able to compete in this new space. And, you know, having actually been involved, we're getting a lot of our revenue currently doing consulting work. So we're actually helping a lot of studio and new business. And we're looking into a lot of those. And so, you know, we actually pays the bill very well doing other work based on our area of expertise beyond just building the technology. And what we're also looking towards is helping, working with people on innovative way of entertaining people, finding new ways where we can create content, deliver the content, and bring us closer to the consumer of the content.
Well, I said earlier I had the immense pleasure of hearing you talk when you were talking to Ed at SidGraph. You're giving your own presentation at SIDGRAPH Asia in Singapore. What can someone expect, and how, you know, what are you planning on talking about?
I hope to reflect on the changes in the industry and hopefully give some guidance, I think, for people in Asia, something that they can learn from my mistakes in the past, and hopefully help inspire other people to, you know, take on these new challenges with a fresh perspective. That's really, I think, is important. I think we don't get enough vision conveyed in Asia to help Asian. It's really, you know, like one thing when we started doing work in Asia from DreamWorks, I told Jeffrey, I said up front, I said, look, if we're going to do this, you kind of let me do it my way. We're not going to go over there and tell them how we do things. We're going to go there and understand how they do things and help them become better. You know, the respect for the culture, respect for the team and the people is very important, because the creative environment is not about your process, it's about the people. So we actually took a lot of pride in our accomplishment in focusing on understanding the culture and the people and making sure we are there in a way that we can help it.
Well, look, I have immense admiration for both what you've managed to pull off technically, creatively, but also, as I say, from a business point of view over the course of your career. And I think it's just a complete gem of an opportunity to hear you speak in person. I'm certainly looking forward to being in the front row when you turn up at SIDGRAPH Asia. So thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today. We really appreciate it.
No, it was my pleasure.
Well, thanks to Mike and Richard for that. Before we close out, I'd like to thank our FX Insider members who support the site through their contributions. As a thank you for donations, as part of the FX Insider program, we give exclusive access to additional content, things like member-only articles, additional FX breakdowns, and more. Details can be found at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. In addition to this FX podcast you've been listening to, we do two other regular audio podcasts. The first one is the VFX Show, which reviews visual effects and current releases, as well as classic films. And then the RC podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. If you enjoyed this podcast, we'd also recommend our HD video podcast, FX Guide TV. All of these can be found at fxguide.com. We also have a sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training, as I mentioned in the intro. That'll do it for this FX podcast. This is Jeff Huser. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, we'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.